From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the CIA's secret war in Afghanistan and the men behind it. We talk with George Kreil, a producer for 60 Minutes and 60 Minutes 2, and author of Charlie Wilson's War. During the 1980s, with the help of the CIA, hundreds of thousands of weapons were smuggled into Afghanistan for the Afghan Mujahideen in their fight against the invading Soviet Union. Charlie Wilson was the congressman from East Texas who took up the cause of the Afghan fighters and helped funnel money their way. We'll also talk with Charlie Wilson, who has since retired from Congress and is now a lobbyist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Saudi officials say yesterday's attacks at Western compounds in Riyadh left 20 people dead, including 7 Americans. 9 other bodies found in the wreckage are believed to be those of attackers. Gunmen attacked the sentries at the compounds, opened the gates, and detonated truck bombs inside. President Bush condemned the bombing, saying they may have been the work of al-Qaeda. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president's comments about the bombing came as he concluded a tour of recent tornado damage in the town of Pierce City, Missouri. It was raining hard as Mr. Bush spoke to reporters in front of a local business. He was asked about the nature of the bomb attack in the Saudi capital of Riyadh.
It doesn't take much money to put a car bomb together. It takes hatred. It takes hatred in your heart. It takes an absolute disregard for innocent life. And that's the nature of al-Qaeda. I can't say for certain it was al-Qaeda yet. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was.
The bombing did prompt criticism of the White House by Florida Senator Bob Graham, a Democrat running for president, who said the administration has lost focus in fighting the war on terror. He said the diversion of resources to the war in Iraq allowed al-Qaeda to regenerate. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
U.S. forces say they found another truck trailer in Iraq that could have been used as a mobile weapons laboratory. The commander of the Army's 101st Airborne Division said the trailer was found in a former missile research facility in northern Iraq. He said it's nearly identical to a trailer that was found in the same area last month. The first trailer is being examined by experts at Baghdad International Airport. Officials said the exposed surfaces in the first trailer had been washed with an ammonia-like cleaner that could have destroyed all traces of biological agents. They said the trailer would be dismantled so that hard-to-reach areas could be tested. Meanwhile, a mass grave has been found about 50 miles southeast of Baghdad. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports from the Iraqi capital.
The Iraqi National Congress announced the discovery at a press conference in Baghdad. Intifad Kanbar is a spokesman for the INC.
In the last week, 4 sites have been discovered in Al-Hilla city alone, with approximately 15,000 bodies.
Kanbar could not explain how INC arrived at that number. He said relatives of missing people were digging up bodies, and he appealed to human rights groups to bring in forensic experts to properly count and identify the remains. Several mass graves have been discovered in northern Iraq, where a campaign against the Kurdish people is thought to have killed thousands. The INC, a group of mainly Iraqi exiles who have returned to the country to help create a new government, wants to gather evidence for possible war crimes investigations against the Saddam Hussein regime. Christopher Joyce, NPR News, Baghdad.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 47 points to close at 8,679. The Nasdaq lost 1 point to close at 1,539. This is NPR News. The United States has ordered the expulsion of 14 Cuban diplomats in Washington and New York. Linda Fasulo reports from the United Nations.
U.S. officials say 7 Cuban diplomats attached to Cuba's mission to the United Nations were ordered to leave the country. The United States accused them of engaging in activities deemed harmful to the U.S., the usual diplomatic language for spying. It is not yet clear when they will have to depart. Meanwhile, a State Department spokesman said 7 Cuban diplomats attached to the Cuban interest section in Washington were ordered to leave the U.S. within 10 days for the same reason. Diplomatic tensions between the United States and Cuba have been on the rise. In April, the U.S. walked out of a U.N. session in protest over Cuba's re-election to the Human Rights Commission, weeks after 78 Cuban journalists, librarians, and others were given lengthy jail sentences. In March, Havana limited travel by U.S. diplomats in Cuba. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
Emergency workers in Chicago have now joined a nationwide anti-terrorism drill. Dozens of participants showed up at Chicago hospitals complaining of flu-like symptoms in a scenario in which a fictitious terrorist group detonated a mock biological weapon. Dr. David Hazard, an emergency room physician at Lutheran General Hospital, says he thinks the drill will be helpful.
It feels real when you have 40 people show up coughing and some collapsing to the ground. It's all pretend, of course, but it feels very real. There's a real feeling of urgency that's taking place.
The week-long drill began yesterday in Seattle with the explosion of a simulated dirty bomb, the kind designed to spread radiation. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt and more. Activist Erin Brockovich will speak at the Stonyfield Farm Strong Women Summit in November. Details at stonyfield.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The war in Afghanistan in the 1980s between the Afghan fighters known as the Mujahideen and the invading Soviet army transformed the world. The Afghan victory contributed to the fall of communism. The Afghans won with weapons and training covertly funded by the CIA. Our arming of their jihad has had many unintended consequences. My guest George Kreil has written a new book about this story, which he describes as the biggest and most successful CIA covert campaign in history. Kreil is a longtime producer at 60 Minutes, who now works on 60 Minutes 2. His new book is called Charlie Wilson's War, named after the former Democratic Texas congressman who, along with CIA operative Gus Avrakatos, were the main figures behind the covert operation. Charlie Wilson was an unlikely figure to back a so-called holy war. Kreil says Wilson's reputation in Congress was as a seemingly corrupt, alcoholic, scandal-prone womanizer. We'll meet Wilson a little later. I ask Kreil how Charlie Wilson was introduced to the Afghan cause.
Through a most unlikely figure, a Houston socialite who was part of the oil-rich world of Texas in the 70s, and an arch-conservative who most reporters at the time who wrote about her described her as a kind of mix between Scarlett O'Hara, Dolly Parton, and I'd like to throw in Arianna Huffington. In any case, she was totally the kind of person that could only be created in Texas. And she was General Zia-ul Haq, the dictator of Pakistan's honorary consul and his principal advisor on America, if you can believe it. And she was also a great, passionate, conspiratorial anti-communist. And for some odd reason, she came upon her once the Russians invaded Afghanistan, that if she could just put Zia-ul Haq, this magnificent Muslim dictator, and the Mujahideen of Afghanistan, who were heroically fighting the Russians without any weapons, if she could put them together with this congressman she had met, who had supported the independent oil interests so effectively, that she could change the world. That they would combine and they would go deliver a lethal blow to the Soviet Empire. And that's curiously just what happened.
Now, Congressman Charlie Wilson managed to get a lot of money from the CIA for arming the Mujahideen. How did he, as a congressman, manage to make that connection with the CIA?
With great difficulty. The CIA at all costs wanted to avoid having anything to do with him. They felt that he was a cocaine-sniffing, scandal-prone, skirt-chasing danger, you know, probably the most notorious, wildest man of Congress at the time. And their reaction when he came into their lives offering to increase their budget to fight a secret war in Afghanistan was to look with absolute horror at such an offer. They felt, with friends like that, we need no enemies. And what ensued was a knockdown, drag-out fight. But it was only possible because of the curiosities of Congress and his position on the Appropriations Committee.
How important was he on the Appropriations Committee, and how did that help him?
Well, if you think of our country is so huge, And the number of things that Congress has to deal with are just so vast that it all gets broken down into areas of responsibility. And if you're, when it came to the CIA, if you were not on one of several committees, you really couldn't even talk to them. And no congressman, no member of Congress had ever been able to insinuate himself inside an actual covert operation. That was a line that had been drawn and maintained very effectively ever since the beginning of the Cold War and the beginning of the CIA. But what you have is with the Appropriations Committee, where the money is actually spent, when you drop it down to the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, you will have 11 people in the House responsible ultimately for deciding how much money the Pentagon gets, the NSA, the CIA, all the intelligence agencies. And Charlie Wilson was one of those 11. And it was just like you always heard with Pork Barrel, in that you could see that one of the powerful members on that subcommittee would suddenly have defense contracts in his district, and he'd have bases and things like that. Charlie Wilson was one of the people that was a brilliant backroom politician, and he just always voted for everybody's programs and never asked for anything in return until the Afghan War. I'm sorry, that's not really true. He never asked for anything in return except for Israel. He was a pioneering non-Jewish champion of Israel in the Appropriations Committee. But after Israel, it was the only thing he really called for and asked for was his colleagues' support in escalating the secret war in Afghanistan over the objection of the CIA.
Now, he finally had an ally in the CIA. Who was the ally?
A most unexpected character named Gus Avracados. By the time that Wilson met him, he was both had a very distinguished history at the CIA as a kind of, I call him the blue-collar James Bond, but also a person who had alienated most everybody. And he was very, very distressed with what he thought bureaucratic cowardice that had come over the CIA and the domination of the agency by lawyers. And what happened in this case is that Avracados, who had been making his way in a very dramatic and bizarre fashion to a position in the Afghan task force, had encountered Wilson's attempt to force the CIA into a larger war. And without telling any of his superiors, he took off in a car, went down to Congress, and entered Wilson's office completely unauthorized and confronted him with the challenge that if you think you want to fight the Russians and kill the Russians more than me, you're crazy. And he did it in such a way that it made Charlie feel that maybe he might physically attack him. He's a really tough customer. And from that moment on, the two of them began to engage in a partnership and what amounts to down and dirty plotting to figure out how, with Avracados' information of how things happen in the CIA and what Wilson should say using his power on the Appropriations Committee, how they could put the CIA into a box where it had no choice but to accept stunning amounts of money that they didn't want to spend.
How did they do that? What was their approach?
The moment Avracados walked into the Rayburn House office building, closed the door, and began to talk to Wilson, everything changed. And it changed because what he did is that he told Wilson exactly what to say to Bill Casey, who was then the CIA director. And he did it in the following way. He said, as soon as I leave, you call the director and say that you just got $50 million more that you can give to the CIA, and you want to know if they can use it. And by the way, I just had run into Gus Avracados, and I told him about this and asked him to look into it. At that point, Casey had no real choice but to call Avracados and ask if he could use the money, because he needed to know that Avracados had not told Wilson that he could. And what Wilson always had in the back of his ace and hidden away that he could pull out is that Ronald Reagan's rhetoric was so powerful and his popularity so great that he would simply say, if you do not support the Afghans with everything they need and with the money I'm offering you, I'll go to the president who is calling for this this support and complain. And he meant it. He meant that he would probably destroy these, you know, the CIA bureaucrats. And nobody in a high position in the CIA had ever engaged a congressman willing to out them, essentially.
Was the CIA very interested in supporting the Afghans? I mean, you talk in your book about how this was one war in which the real enemy, the way they saw it, the real enemy, the Soviets, could actually be directly engaged. It wasn't a war with Soviet proxies. It was a war with the Soviets themselves. Was that very appealing to the CIA?
Yes and no, but mainly no, in that they didn't want to do it in the way that Wilson and Avracados ultimately forced them to do it.
Too risky?
Yeah, much too risky. I mean, what had happened by that year, or by that time in the early 1980s, the CIA had more or less established a pattern of conduct where they were engaged in endless war. It was almost as if it was viewed as permanent campaigns on the fringes to contain the Soviets. And the one thing they didn't want to do is to take on any kind of provocative campaigns that could escalate into some unforeseen drama. And in the case of Afghanistan and Pakistan, they had no choice but to use General Zia, the military dictator of Pakistan, President Zia, and Pakistan as the base of operations. And it was provocative because the United States, for the very first time, was supporting anti-communist guerrillas who were moving to kill Soviet soldiers. And that had never happened in the Cold War. It was the very first time that the United States actually set out to kill our enemy, to mount operations designed to kill Russians.
So the CIA didn't want the Soviets to know that it was that Americans were arming the Afghans to the extent that we were.
There was a kind of a sense that we could get away with a lot if the United States was just sensible, and that if it did a calibrated escalation in which the idea would be to win fantastic propaganda victories, which we were doing, to inflict a certain amount of pain, which we were doing through blowing things up and killing a certain number of Russians. But what changed the dynamic here completely is that Wilson, in conjunction with Gustav Avracados, transformed the whole idea. They suddenly decided to hijack a covert policy and to take the United States for the very first time in the Cold War into a all-out, winner-take-all confrontation, to turn the tables on the Russians and give them in Afghanistan their own Vietnam. It was sort of payback time in their minds. And it was something that the CIA at all costs wanted to avoid doing. And it was a knockdown, drag-out fight that stretched over a couple of years and then ultimately resulted in a total victory for Charlie Wilson.
My guest is George Kreil, author of the new book, Charlie Wilson's War. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is George Kreil, a longtime documentary producer for CBS, both for 60 Minutes and now for 60 Minutes 2. He's the author of the new book, Charlie Wilson's War, The Extraordinary Story of the Largest Covert Operation in history. And it's the story of how Congressman Charlie Wilson helped convince the CIA to covertly arm the Mujahideen in its war in the 1980s against the Soviet Union.
Terry, can I give you a context here?
Sure.
You know, if you think back to that time when this story begins, right after the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, Christmas of 1979, just about a month later, the Afghans are a lost cause. The whole world has come to recognize, with 100,000 Russian troops in Afghanistan, with the invincible Red Army occupying the country, that the story is over. And the terrible scenes that were broadcast around the world of the Afghans beginning to flee their country and the beginnings of what came to be called a genocidal war were very evident. And there was nothing really that they could do to change the picture. They just had World War I rifles and hunting rifles and this ferocious fighting spirit and conviction. But at that moment, they had nothing really that could help them other than, as in a fairy tale, they needed a heroic figure to emerge out of somewhere and magically come to their rescue. And there was such a person, curiously. But at that moment, he was stepping into a hot tub in Las Vegas at Caesar's Palace in the Fantasy Suite with two naked women with cocaine in their purses. And it is so odd to think that this is the man, Charlie Wilson, Congressman Charlie Wilson, who will get himself out of the hot tub and pull himself together in about a year and a half after this, discover the Afghans, discover this cause. And for a period of about 5 years, he will emerge as the centerpiece in the biggest and meanest and most successful CIA campaign in history, and will be responsible for giving or making possible a total victory for militant Islam in the greatest jihad of modern history.
Do you think that the fundamentalist Muslims who Charlie Wilson helped arm had a sense of who he was as a man and, you know, his kind of sexual appetites, his whole world, which was all about, which had so much to do with pleasure seeking?
There was a line that has always haunted me that's helped me to follow this story because the characters are so wonderfully bizarre and fascinating. And it goes like this, that Allah writes straight with crooked lines. And it's the only way to make sense out of any of this, because how could Charlie Wilson, with personal belly dancers and beauty queens and hot tubs and naked women, somehow become the sponsor and patron of the greatest jihad with these fundamentalist Muslims who he loved and who loved him, other than through mystical forces that you can't really explain?
Did he bring his friends, the former beauty queens and the belly dancer, with him to Afghanistan?
Always. First time he went to out to Afghanistan, he was charmed by the Mujahideen. He was moved by them. But he was something of a hedonist, I guess you'd have to say. At that point, he was caught up in what he calls the longest midlife crisis in history. And he decided that once he found out there was no alcohol, no women, that he was never going to the Islamic world again without a good Christian girl by his side. And the people he brought were just unbelievable. They were almost invariably, they were former beauty queens, small-town girls with big, wondrous eyes that were being given a queen-for-a-day experience that they, to this day, look back on as being the high point of their lives. And even a belly dancer from Dallas, Texas.
Well, let's get back to the covert arming of the Mujahideen. What arrangement was Charlie Wilson, with the CIA, able to arrange to covertly get high-tech weapons to the Afghan Mujahideen who were fighting the Soviets in the 1980s?
You know, you'd think that the CIA could take care of all of its own arms purchases easily. But in the Cold War, they had a hard and fast rule that they would not ever introduce weapons into a secret war that could be traced back to the United States. And so they had to go through an elaborate process in the black markets to get Soviet weapons that could be claimed to be captured on the battlefield. And the big problem that existed at that point was these flying gunships, which the Hind helicopter, which no matter how many times the Mujahideen, the Afghans, would shoot at that helicopter, the bullets would just bounce off of its armor, and they would sit up there and just mow down people by the thousands. And it was a terrible problem, and Wilson became completely preoccupied by it, and to a certain extent, the CIA people did too. But they didn't know what to do, and they didn't really know where to go. It just so happened, though, and how you could explain this, I don't know. It just so happened that Charlie's best friend and drinking buddy at that point was the minister, the wildly powerful minister of defense of Egypt, Mohammed Abu Ghazala, who had told Charlie, come to Egypt, and I will open my storehouse of weapons, and you can buy whatever you want. And Egypt had once been a client state of Russia, so they had all these weapons. And so the CIA, so Wilson, in his very first trip, after getting his foot in the door with the CIA, led this delegation, headed by Gustav Rakatos, to Egypt, where the doors to the arsenals were open because of his great friend Mohammed.
So the United States used Soviet missiles that the Soviets sold to Egypt that the U.S. bought from Egypt to covertly arm the Afghans against the Soviets.
That was one of many, many channels. But at that time, once the war started to escalate and they needed, you know, we're talking numbers that are hard to conceive. Maybe as many as 500,000 Afghans, fundamentalist Islamic warriors who were carrying CIA-issued weapons. And once Charlie Wilson's war began with his funding levels and Avrakatos's secret partnership, they started to introduce very sophisticated weapons and mixes of weapons. And this called for getting governments to provide that, that had Soviet manufactured weapons, the Chinese, the Egyptians. And in this case, there's a fantastic story is connected to each one of these channels that were opened up.
George Crile is the author of the new book, Charlie Wilson's War, the extraordinary story of the largest covert operation in history. Crile is also a producer at 60 Minutes and 60 Minutes 2. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of Odd Girl Out by Rachel Simmons, about the hidden culture of female bullying and cruelty among girls and how people can help. Available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet Charlie Wilson, the former congressman who took up the Afghan Mujahideen as his cause and is the subject of the book Charlie Wilson's War. And we continue our conversation with the book's author, George Crile. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with George Crile, author of the new book Charlie Wilson's War, the extraordinary story of the largest covert operation in history. It's about the CIA's covert backing of the Afghan Mujahideen in their fight against the invading Soviet army in the 1980s. Charlie Wilson, who was at the time a Democratic congressman from Texas, was one of the main figures behind the covert operation. Let's pick up where we left off. Once the CIA funding of the covert operations in Afghanistan increased, where did Pakistan fit in?
From the beginning, there was no war. There was no Afghan war. There was no Afghan resistance, were it not for Pakistan. And even today, when you hear about the great hunt for bin Laden, there is an area called a tribal zone between Afghanistan and that stretches into Pakistan, but for a certain number of miles, tribal law prevails, not Pakistan law. And it really is an extension of Afghanistan. And so you have the same tribal mix, and the war was always based really in Pakistan and in this tribal zone, where the same primarily Pashtun warriors, the famous Afghans who defeated the English and the Russians were based. But Pakistan was everything, because its president, Zia-ul-Haq, was a dictator, and so he was able to dictate that there would be a base of operations for the Afghans. But he put down a pretty hard set of conditions to the CIA in the United States, which is that his intelligence service, the ISI, would be responsible for distributing the weapons and running the Afghans with limited supervision from the CIA.
There are other things you say he wanted from the United States. For example, he expected the United States to turn its head regarding Pakistan's nuclear weapons program.
Well, he certainly did. And at the heart of everything, curiously, with Zia was not so much his dealings with the U.S. government, but the set of relationships he had with this woman who got Charlie Wilson into the war, Joanne Herring, unusual Texas character who was the honorary consul to Pakistan, and Charlie Wilson, because Zia came to rely on Wilson's word that if Charlie said that he could count on military assistance of a certain amount, that then he would go ahead and allow escalations of the war. And every time there were huge battles over whether Pakistan was working on the bomb, on what everybody called the Islamic bomb, there would be knockdown, drag-out fights in which Wilson would always organize the resistance and keep the money flowing. And it did keep flowing, and it was a condition of Zia's. And it kept flowing until the Russians left, whereupon we immediately discovered that they were working on the bomb, and with great apparent or ostensible shock, imposed sanctions and cut off military assistance.
Were there any concerns in Congress or in the CIA or in the Reagan administration that the United States was going to be arming Islamic fundamentalists with high-tech weapons, training these warriors how to use the weapons, while knowing that a lot of the Islamic fundamentalists hated the United States? They didn't just hate the Soviets.
There was certainly a good deal of concern inside the CIA in the early years when Charlie Wilson was trying to force them to escalate this war. And one of their perfectly understandable concerns was that, you know, what happens afterward? What are the unintended consequences? Is it a good idea to get, is to make this a huge war? Would it provoke a Pakistani or an attack by the Red Army, the Russians, on Pakistan? What consequences could that have? What are we going to do with all of these Muslim fundamentalists? What kind of weapons, what kind of training is appropriate to give to them? And all of those questions were very real and part of the initial battle that the CIA waged to try to prevent this massive escalation. But the truth is, once they got into it, once they lost the battle with Charlie Wilson and the secret partner, Gustav Rakatos, helping him from within the CIA, once they lost it and the money started to flow in and the war started to escalate and the tide started to turn, the CIA became absolutely giddy and thrilled at this battle, because it was the first time that they were actually setting out to kill the enemy, to engage him in a winner-take-all battle. And no one thought that this was possible to win, but they increasingly came to think it would be. And then it happened. And for the longest time, this was viewed as the great triumph of the CIA in the last campaign of the Cold War.
How long do you think it took for the CIA to start thinking about the blowback, about the bad unintended consequences of arming the Mujahideen?
I think we have a problem in our country, period, when it comes to the aftermath of campaigns like this. You're starting to see it in Afghanistan today. Hopefully we don't find it in Iraq. But, I think that the simple answer is that they really worried about it, but didn't think too much about it for a long time, because so many incredible things were happening. Almost immediately after the Russians withdrew, after this thing that President Zia of Afghanistan called the miracle of the century, when the Red Army turned tail and walked out with their own Vietnam haunting them, everything started to tumble. You know, it wasn't very long before the wall came down, and it wasn't long before the Velvet Revolution and the fall of communism. Too many things were happening that were too exciting for anyone to worry about what was happening inside Afghanistan. And because it was a secret campaign, and because people didn't really understand that it had been a huge victory, there was no sense of accountability to the Afghans, or a sense that we had to worry about whether we had a responsibility to stay in there and try to help rebuild the country. So it was the blowback concerns, the whole sense of the unintended consequences, probably didn't really set in until the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993.
George Crile, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
George Crile is the author of the new book, Charlie Wilson's War, the extraordinary story of the largest covert operation in history. Crile is also a producer at 60 Minutes, too. Coming up, we talk with Charlie Wilson. This is Fresh Air. Charlie Wilson is the focus of the book we were just discussing, Charlie Wilson's War, about the CIA's covert funding of the Afghan Mujahideen and their battle against the invading Soviet army in the 1980s. At the time, Wilson was a Democratic congressman from Texas. He took on the Mujahideen's cause as his own and became one of the leading figures behind their covert funding. After serving 24 years in Congress, Wilson is now a lobbyist for Pakistan. I asked him why he felt so strongly about the Afghan cause.
I was outraged, of course, Christmas of 1979, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan for no reason other than simple aggression. And I thought that, well, this will just be another case of 6 weeks, and they'll pacify the country and kill all the fighters, and it'll just be another satellite. But after several months, it began to dawn on me that the Afghans, without weapons, were killing Russian officers in Kabul with knives and stones and anything they could get their hands on. And then it became clear to me, and I think this is the most important single part of this war, it became clear to me that the Afghans had made a decision themselves, without American or any Western participation, but they had made a decision themselves to fight till the end if they had to fight with their bare hands. And I just strongly felt that people that brave, that were that opposed to being subdued by the evil empire, if you will, that that we would be damned by history if we let them fight with their hands. And so that my interest was aroused there. And after another few months, I made a trip just to see for myself as much as I could see along the border there. I had been friendly with Pakistan before this. And when I visited the hospitals and saw the children with their feet and hands blown off by the Soviet mines that had been disguised to look like toys and that sort of thing, and I just became radicalized.
Now, at the time, you were living a lifestyle very different from the Afghan Mujahideen. I mean, you were hanging out in casinos, hot tubs, relationships with beauty pageant queens. Is there an example you can think of the most unusual coming together of cultures, your culture and their culture?
Well, let's see. There certainly wasn't an example that had anything to do with alcohol, because I didn't do that in front of them. I suppose the fact that I was single at the time, and I've been traveling to exciting and exotic places, you like to have someone to share it with. And so I suppose the fact that I wasn't married and they saw me with different Western girlfriends was a major shock to them, although they never gave any evidence of it. They didn't lift an eyebrow. There was one, and it's a passage in the book, but as an example, the most fundamentalist of all the fundamentalists, and he's now wanted. He's now wanted as a Islamic terrorist, but his name was Hekmatyar Gulbuddin. And I had, at one point during the war, I knew that we couldn't get quite, this was at the time when the rules were that all the weapons had to be Soviet bloc weapons. And we were short of some AK-47s and other, and RPG-7s, which is an anti-tank rocket. And we were short of those, and I knew that Israel had a large number of them. And so I was proposing that we buy from the Israelis the weapons they'd captured from the Palestinians and other enemies they had, and that we buy from the Israelis and furnish them to the Mujahideen. Well, some of the people in the agency and others in the American diplomatic corps said, were horrified by that, and they said they'll never accept a weapon from that had anything to do with Israel. So I asked Hekmatyar Gulbuddin, who was the most, as I said, the most radical fundamentalist of all of the Mujahideen leaders, and he had a very interesting reply. He said, "We use weapons that we take from wounded and killed Soviet soldiers. So I don't know why we can't use a weapon that Allah provides from Israel."
And so is that what you did? You got Israeli weapons that Israelis had gotten from Palestinians and sold those to the Afghans?
Well, we didn't sell anything to the Afghans. We gave it to them.
You gave it to them, excuse me. Yeah. So that's what you did. Okay.
That's what we did.
There's an expression called blowback to describe the unintended consequences of a war. What surprised you most about the blowback after the Afghan war with the Soviets?
Of course, and I take my full share of the blame, but... And at the time, I didn't realize how serious it was. But the United States, once the communist government had fallen, once the Russians had left, we sort of lost interest, the United States and other Western countries. And because of that, we created a vacuum. And Afghans in a vacuum tend to fight each other for power. And there were many of them that had been radicalized on the Islamic side from their war with the godless Soviets. It was largely our responsibility because we should have stayed there and we should have insisted that they somehow work together. We should have held out a lot of carrots and more or less forced them to work together, or at least not to go to war with one another. And I was surprised by that. The Taliban then, when they really came in and totally filled the vacuum, and many people in Afghanistan supported the Taliban that did not adhere to their religious beliefs or to their philosophy, but simply because they saw them as the first chance to have order in 15 or 18 years, to not have war, I was stunned and totally surprised. Felt very badly about it.
Anything you would do differently if you were going about helping to arm the Mujahideen? If you're doing that again?
No.
You do
nothing
it all
the same. I do differently. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, what I would do differently, profoundly differently, would be to try to prevent, and I don't think one congressman could have done it, but I would have tried to prevent the immense distraction that our country had with the falling of the Berlin Wall, with the freedom in Poland and Czechoslovakia and all the others, where we just completely were distracted from the problems in Afghanistan. I would try to persuade the administration, that was the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration, that was extremely sympathetic to the cause of the Mujahideen, and I would have tried to persuade them to not leave and to maintain an American presence and to do whatever was necessary in the form of a mini Marshall Plan, not only in our own interest to keep something like the Taliban from gaining control of the country that provided a refuge for Osama bin Laden, but also to say thank you, because these people are the ones that shed the blood that defeated the Red Army for the first time it had left its barracks since 1945. And we owed them a great deal, and in my view, never properly said thank you.
What are some of the things you think the CIA did to try to hide the fact that it was funding the weapons for the Mujahideen and that it was funding intelligence? Yeah.
I don't think that the Soviets were ever fooled. They were fooled for the first few years, first maybe till 1983, something like 84. They were fooled by the magnitude, but it was taking us that long to get everything in the pipeline. As the book points out, the Chinese connection, the Egyptian connection, and all the rest. But I think that they knew that that it was a far bigger piece of cake than they had intended to bite off in 84 and 85. And then in 86, when the Stingers started shooting down their Hind helicopters, which were their major and most effective weapon, then they knew it was a fight to the death.
My guest is former Congressman Charlie Wilson, the subject of the new book, Charlie Wilson's War, the extraordinary story of the largest covert operation in history. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
My guest is Charlie Wilson, the subject of the new book, Charlie Wilson's War. In the 1980s, when he was a Democratic congressman from Texas, he became one of the main figures behind the CIA's covert funding of the Afghan Mujahideen in their war against the invading Soviet army. You're lobbying for Pakistan now. What are some of the issues or business interests that you represent?
Well, I don't represent any business interest. I represent the country of Pakistan. And we just, you try to present your client in the best possible light to Congress. You try to not have crippling amendments. You try to defeat sanction legislation or anything that would be damaging to them. And many, many countries have lobbyists, the Greeks, the Turks, the Colombians. Of course, there's an enormous homegrown lobby for Israel in the United States. That's the most powerful. The second most powerful are probably the Indians, the Hindus. Third most powerful are probably the Armenians.
You've been described as, and I think, in fact, you even described yourself as having gone through the world's longest midlife crisis. Do you feel like you're still going through that, or do you think?
No, I'm recovered from that.
You're recovered from that. So, yeah. How has your life changed since recovering from that?
Well, I have a lovely wife. I live a totally monogamous life. I don't drink whiskey or wine or beer anymore. And so all of my bad habits are gone, Terry. Or all of the habits that other people would judge to be bad, or that some people would judge to be bad.
What's your assessment of how the United States is doing in Afghanistan now? Do you think that the United States is doing enough to help rebuild the country?
I think that the United States is trying and doing a much better job than we did after the last one. I think we're into the road building. I think we're into providing jobs. I think we're into stringing electric wire and some of the things that we do the best. But I really think that as, this is as best I can tell from the newspapers. I think that we've made a mistake by not pacifying the whole country. As I understand it, we're basically just pacifying Kabul.
What do you mean by pacifying?
Right now, there are still areas in which warlords of different ethnic groups rule different parts of the country.
What do you mean by pacify?
Well, by pacify, I mean maintain law and order. Maintain the rule of law in Kandahar and in Jalalabad and in Herat, not just in Kabul. Without the whole country, the capital's kind of an empty shell.
Are some of the warlords or former warlords in Afghanistan now people who you worked with when they were members of the Mujahideen?
Not that I know of, but some of the people I worked with in the Mujahideen are on the wanted list and are apparently have joined the ranks of the very radical Islamic militant criminal groups. And I say that with great sadness because I really cared for some of them.
Do you feel personally betrayed, or do you feel like you didn't quite get what was happening?
No. I feel like we didn't do enough and that we could have kept those guys on our side.
Mm-hmm. What went through your mind on September 11th when you heard, when you found out that it was Islamic fundamentalists who were behind the attacks?
Well, I was very grievous and devastated, and somehow I knew that I felt very badly about that. I didn't feel conscience-stricken. I just felt sad. I felt sad of the cruelty of the attacks and the fanaticism of the attacks, and the fact that they obviously were coming from radical Islamic people, who I still felt that we were in great debt to many of, for really driving the nail in the coffin of the evil empire. And then to see them not on our side was a tough nut for me.
Well, Charlie Wilson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You bet.
Charlie Wilson was one of the main figures behind the CIA's covert funding of the Afghan Mujahideen in their war against the invading Soviet army. He's also the subject of the new book, Charlie Wilson's War, by George Kreil. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track from a new CD by composer and pianist Carla Bley. This is OG Can You See from her Variations on the National Anthem.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of On the Nature of Human Romantic Interaction, fictional stories by Carl Yanyama. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, historian Robert Dalek talks about his new biography of John F. Kennedy, which reveals new information about Kennedy's health problems, his adulterous relationships, and his political career. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.